My intention today is to make less mysterious some of the things that may have seemed mysterious yesterday. In particular, one item of mystery that was left unclear in yesterday's talk was how does the introduction of SLE allow us to resolve any of the questions about the models that were like percolation or maybe the easing model or some of the other models that were hard to grasp mathematically before. Why does SLE help us answer these questions? And that will be done via an example. I will show an example how you can do an SLE calculation to deduce some property of a model. So this part assumes that SLE, the connection between SLE and some model has been established, and just works straight with SLE to derive some properties. And this is just an example calculation, but many of the other calculations are rather similar, and if you will understand this one, this is basically a good representative of some of the other facts that that we can establish with SLE. The second phase of today's talk answers a different mystery, which is how do we show that a particular model converges to SLE? And in this case, I chose the simplest model for which this is known, the simplest proof of this kind. This simple proof, though it is simple, it is illustrative of a technique which has been applied to three different or maybe four different models. So it is also quite representative. Before we will get into that, I will give a brief review of the basic definitions from yesterday. I will maybe give the perspective will be a little bit different, and I will give a little bit more details about how the definitions go, but without any of the motivation. So if you weren't here yesterday and you're here today, then some of what I will say will be highly unmotivated and should be quite surprising out of the blue. And tomorrow's talk will discuss a topic that is not so closely related with SLE. It's dynamical percolation, since there are quite a few dynamical systems people in the audience. I thought this would be appropriate and interesting. The connection with SLE is only via some results that are proved with SLE and then used in this work. Let's go back. Yesterday I discussed SLE, but I didn't, which is stochastic Lerner evolution, but I didn't tell you what Lerner's theorem is. So let me begin by doing that. In the simplest context, we have a path in the upper half plane, gamma, defined on the interval from 0 to capital T. And to make things simple, we take it to be a simple path, and it starts on the boundary, but later on it stays in the upper half plane. And whenever T is a time parameter, the set capital K sub T will denote the set of points described by the path up to time T. Then Riemann's mapping theorem tells us that for every such T, well, it should be up to time capital T. There is a conformal homeomorphism from the set when you slit it, when you take away the path, the upper half plane minus the path to the upper half plane. The existence is given by Riemann's mapping theorem, and then once you normalize appropriately, it's unique. And the convenient normalization is to have infinity map to infinity, the derivative at infinity taking it to be 1, so that amounts to taking away the scaling factor here, which is taken to be 1. And then the next choice is making the translation term be 0. You can translate this map if you like. You can you choose the translation near infinity to approach 0 near infinity, and then the rest of the map is determined, and this is called the hydrodynamic normalization. Okay, well, I don't know much about this, but there were some when you try to do an analysis of something like the behavior of a wing under a moving airflow, but you're thinking of a two-dimensional system, then, well, there is no conformal invariance really in that system, but some aspects of the system behave as if they were nearly conformally invariant, and therefore, in that setting, it was natural to make this normalization. That's as much as I know about this. Okay, and now we will discuss a little bit this first term, A1, which is the first term which you cannot get rid of by normalizing. And this A1 is called the capacity. It's denoted by capital A sometimes. Capital A, either of GT or the set KT, because each one of these determines the other. And you can also write it as the limit as Z tends to infinity of Z times GT minus Z. That's a consequence of this expansion. Now, this capacity has a nice property. It's a homomorphism. Namely, when you compose the map, the corresponding capacities add. And this is easy to see because you can just compose our maps. You can compose two maps that are normalized in this way and see what happens to the composition. And you can see that the A1 is additive. And if we look at the boundary values, we can see that the imaginary part of GT of Z minus Z is everywhere non-positive. Well, this is a harmonic function because GT is analytic, so the imaginary part of an analytic function is harmonic. And what do I mean by boundary values? When on the real line, this is both have a zero imaginary part. GT maps the real line to the real line. On the curve, GT maps something with positive imaginary part to something on the real line. So this thing is negative on the curve, and near infinity, this quantity approaches zero. And therefore, the boundary values are in general negative, and since the harmonic functions satisfy maximum principle, you can see that this quantity is always non-negative, and that implies that A1 is larger than zero, because A1 can be defined in this way. And so, you see, when you take... when you increase T, you're essentially composing G by another map, because if you take away one slit, you map by GT, and then you take away another slit, you map by another mapping. And therefore, extending T amounts to composing GT, and therefore, using this formula and the fact that A1 is positive, you can see that the capacity is increasing in time. And therefore, well, it's not too hard to see that it will also be continuous, and therefore, we may as well take the capacity to be our time parameterization. That, from the conformal point of view, that is the natural parameterization. And for historical reasons, rather than taking the capacity to be T, we take it to be 2T, because that's what Livermore did. Now, we define WT to be the image of the end of the path under the map. Then WT is a point in the real line. Namely, we take this point right here. After we map by GT, it's going to be some point on the real line, maybe here. We don't know. It varies. And here's Livermore's theorem. Livermore's theorem in the chordal setting, well, he had it in the radial setting, but this is essentially the same, tells us how the maps GT evolve over time. The time derivative of GT of Z is given by 2 divided by GT minus W. This is an ordinary differential equation, and you can recover the path gamma T by inverting this equation. And so Livermore's theorem is you can view it as a dimension reduction theorem. It tells you, well, here you have this path in two dimensions, and we can now encode it by a path in one dimension. This WT is a one-dimensional path on the real line. The gamma T is a two-dimensional path. The two-dimensional path was assumed to be a simple path. The way you can try to think about it is that, you know, if you have a driver and the driver is driving in two dimensions, but the instructions can be basically one-dimensional. You say left, right, 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 left, right, right. So the instructions to the driver are a sequence in one dimension, but the output is two-dimensional, and similarly, that's what happens in Livermore's theorem. The change in WT tell you whether the path has to turn left or right, and then the maps, they follow this equation and do what they follow the instructions. And Livermore's theorem can be reversed if we start with some continuous path in one dimension, then we can solve Livermore's equation and then get a one-parameter family of maps. Now, if you look at this equation, the right-hand side blows up when GT of Z hits W. So this equation is, if you fix a Z, this equation is defined only up to some time, which may be finite or infinite, and that's the time where GT of Z hits the singularity W. And you can, to begin with, well, we know in the situation of the path that we start, we know what those points are. Those are the points on the path. In general, if we start with W, we can denote by K sub T the set of points that hit the singularity by time T under the Livermore flow. And then what we get is we get from this one-dimensional path, we get a one-parameter family of maps, and we have an increasing one-parameter family, increasing one-parameter family of sets in the upper half plane, and this one-parameter family is not necessarily an arc of a path, not always. can be rather bad when W is wild. SLE kappa is obtained when we take, for WT, we take Brownian motion at time kappa times T, with time scaled by kappa. And kappa is any non-negative parameter. B here is one-dimensional Brownian motion. In this case, one can show that gamma of T is well-defined and continuous. I mentioned this yesterday. It is a simple path, almost surely only in the range kappa between 0 and 4. Okay, so this was our review. Let me add that in this case, the set K sub T is just the set of points gamma that gamma visits by time T. And here's what I want to give as a hands-on calculation. We're going to derive Cardy's formula for SLE. Cardy's formula was initially motivated by the following problem. It was raised by Michael Eisenman in discussion with Langlands Pouliot Saint-Aubin regarding the bulletin paper from 1995. And the question is, what is the probability to cross from the left side to the right side in a rectangle in this hexagonal mesh where you require a crossing to consist of entirely of white hexagons? And Cardy guessed that the limit as the mesh size goes to zero, this is the probability that you're going to have a crossing. So this is our gamma function. Eta, I will say what eta is in a moment, and F21 is the hypergeometric function. We will make this less mysterious. So this is Cardy's formula again, and eta is the cross ratio when you map the rectangle by a conformal map to the upper half plane. You get the four points corresponding to the corners, and you take their cross ratios, that is eta. Now Leonard Carlson came up with a much nicer version of Cardy's formula. And this is the nicer version. You map the rectangle to a triangle so that the three of the corners get mapped to the three corners of the... I forgot to say, it's an equilateral triangle of edge length 1. So three of the corners get mapped to three of the corners of the triangle, and the fourth corner of the rectangle gets mapped to a point which you have no control of, and let's say that its distance from the top vertex is x. And Carlson's version says that the probability of crossing from this bottom edge to this segment marked of length x, as the mesh goes to zero, converges to x. Which is significantly simpler than this formula. So it seems that percolation prefers triangles to rectangles in some way. That is still a little bit mysterious to me, but I can say that there was some argument about what happens in the Potts model, and then he took a limit as Q goes to zero in the Potts model. Yeah, well, I cannot say much more than this at this point. But Smirnov did prove Cauchy's formula and Carlson's formula. So Carlson's formula is just Cauchy's, is the same as Cauchy's formula when you map the rectangle to the triangle. Carlson basically realized that this map is precisely the mapping from the rectangle to the triangle. And Smirnov proved both of them in a very nice and not too long paper, which we all owe thanks to. Even before Smirnov's proof of the Cauchy-Carlson formula, there was this proof that I'm going to present to you that the analogous formula holds for SLE6, and a similar formula holds for every SLE with you know a few changes here and there. The same proof applies to other SLEs, but let us concentrate on this percolation model. So if we map the problem to the upper half plane, basically let's mark the images of the corners of the rectangle by the points 0, A, B, and infinity. We can map one of the points to infinity and the other to A, and A and B to different sides. And then basically what we're asking is there a crossing from 0 to, from this interval to the interval to the left of B up to minus infinity in white hexagons, right? And if you think about it a little bit, this translates to a question about this red path here. It translates to the question whether this red path first hits these boundary hexagons to the left of B or to the right of A. I mean, the first time it hits the interval outside of the interval from B to A, does it happen to the left of B or to the right of A? If it happens to the left of B, then the right-hand side of this interface will be your white crossing. And if it happens to the right of A, then the left-hand side will be a black crossing between the two other corresponding segments on the boundary, which would make it impossible for any white crossing to occur. And therefore, we're basically asking ourselves, we have this growing hull of this growing set K sub T, and we're asking which set is absorbed by KT first, A or B? Because when the path hits the boundary point, B no longer is part of the domain of definition of the function GT. Namely, it has been absorbed by the singularity, or in other words, GT of B minus WT has hit zero. So the question about crossing probability in the context of SLE translates to the question, which hand hits zero first, GT of A minus WT or GT of B minus W of T? And this is basically a one-dimensional problem, because for this to make sense, you don't need to think about GT as defined in the upper half plane. It's enough for GT to be defined on the real line. All you need is the restriction of GT to the real line to make sense of this version of the problem. And now we will see how it's not too hard to derive from SLE. Suppose that we know the path up to time t, namely we know the driving parameter w up to time t, then the probability of GT of A hitting WT before GT of B hitting W is just a function of these three points, because this relates to the Markov property, which I mentioned yesterday. The only thing W knows about its past and it cares about is the current position. And these points, they just flow according to the equation, and they don't care about the past. They only care about what WT is going to do. And so this is enough information to determine the probability, to, in principle, if we knew how, to determine the probability of A hitting W before B, GT of A hitting W before B. Now, we have scale and translation invariants. It's very easy to see that the whole system is invariant under translation, and namely, if we translate all these three points, nothing changes. And if we scale, also nothing changes. The amount of time which we will have to wait until it occurs changes, but otherwise nothing changes. That's because Brownian motion has this scaling behavior. So we have scale and translation invariant, and therefore, if you look at the function of these three points, that is scale invariant and translation invariant, it must be a function of this quantity. The three parameters reduced to one parameter, which is eta, which is the same as, in fact, as the cross ratio of these three points with infinity, by the way. So it agrees with the previous use of the symbol eta. Up to, well, you know, cross ratios are only, when you say cross ratio, that's only well defined up to six arbitrary but annoying choices. So I'm not sure I've been consistent with these choices, and let's hope I was. Now, the next thing to observe is that this function f of eta of t, so t varies in time, this whole thing changes in time, f of eta of t is, the interpretation of this quantity is, if we know everything that happens up to time t, what is the best estimate for the probability that we're going to see a crossing, namely GT of A hits W before GT of B. Well, this is going to be a martingale. What does that mean? That means that the expected value of f of eta of t is the same as f of eta of 0. Why would that be so? Well, this is basically what's called, it reduces to Bayes' formula. I mean, if you're thinking about some possible outcome, say you're interested in the chance that it will rain the day after tomorrow, and you can divide into two cases. One case is it rains tomorrow, and the other case it doesn't rain tomorrow. So suppose you know that the probability it rains tomorrow is 50%. And given that it rains tomorrow, it's very likely to, say the probability is 75% that it will rain the day after tomorrow. And if it doesn't rain tomorrow, the probability is 25% that it will rain the day after tomorrow. And then you can calculate the probability that it will rain the day after tomorrow. And this is basically a continuous version of this statement, saying that your current expectation for what the probability of events will be is the same as what you expect your expectation to be tomorrow. Okay, so this is the equation that we're going to use. And in particular, at t equals 0, we can take the derivative, the t derivative of this expectation, it must be 0. And that's all we're going to use now. And that's going to be enough, because the plan is that we're going to write a Taylor expansion for this quantity here. We don't want to commute the derivative with the expectation, because the quantity inside the expectation is not going to be differentiable in t, but the expectation will be. So how does this work? Well, we know what eta is. Eta is that thing, so we can assume that f is twice continuously differentiable, and we can write a Taylor expansion for this, because we also know how these gt of a and gt of b terms behave, and we know how what the expectation of wt is and what the expectation of wt square is. See, wt is Brownian motion evaluated at time k sub t, and that has zero expectation, and the second moment is k times t, and this is where kappa times t, and this is where kappa comes in. So if you use these formulas to expand this in power series, and you take the expectation of that power series, what you get is this differential equation for f. And this is the same differential equation that Cardi had with completely different reasoning. And the only solution for this equation that satisfies the obvious boundary conditions, f of 0 is 1 and f of minus infinity is 0, is given by Cardi's formula. And that's it. This is how one derives it. So the point is that you look at some quantity which you know how it's going to evolve. You take its Taylor series expansion, and you use that to derive a differential equation for your unknown function. We've used Taylor's formula, but the real professionals, they instead use Ito calculus, which is just a fancy version of Taylor's formula. So if you ever see Ito's calculus or stochastic calculus, you should know that underneath it all, it's basically an application of Taylor's formula. The next part of the talk, we will prove that specific discrete model converges to SLE. The proof will be essentially a reversal of this type of argument that we saw here. Here we knew what W was, we didn't know what F was, and we knew what the differential equation was, and therefore we concluded a differential equation for F. In our next exercise, we will know F, we will not know W, we will have an equation of this sort, and we will use this equation to deduce properties of W, and therefore deduce that W is Brownian motion. As you can see, there are not so many ideas in this field. We all try to recycle the same ideas in different ways. The harmonic explorer is defined as follows. It's a discrete model introduced in a paper with Scott Sheffield. And the main reason to introduce it was that this was the first model for which we could prove that convergence to SLE 4. It's defined as follows. At each phase, you have an interface. It starts out to be the empty interface on the left-hand side, but at an intermediate stage, you have some interface which has... Oh, white and gray are indistinguishable here. This is... Okay. So... Yeah, well, this is black. This is called black. Yeah, this is called black, and this is called gray, and this is called white. There is a slight, you can see a slight change in shading between these two hexagons if you try hard enough. Or just believe me, okay. I could spend 10 minutes and fix the slide, but rather adjust the slide to the projector because it looks okay here. But rather than that, just trust me that, so the hexagons to the right of the red interface are white, as are the hexagons on this boundary, and these hexagons are gray. And at each stage, you have a red hexagon where white meets black right here at the tip of the red path, and you have to decide whether you color this hexagon white or black. The way you do it, you start a random walk at this hexagon, which walks on hexagons, a simple random walk, and the first time it hits either a white or a black hexagon, you color it by that color. So if it hits, say this hexagon, it's colored white. If it hits this hexagon, it's colored black. If it hits this hexagon, it's colored white, etc. And then once you color that, you can extend the interface one step further, keeping white on the right-hand side and black on the left-hand side. And you go to the next step. And the scaling limit of this process is SLE4. Namely, in this case, it will be the image, if the mesh is fine, it will be the image of SLE4 into this domain by the map taking 0 and infinity to these two boundary points. Here's a simulation of what Harmonic Explorer looks like, and you can think of it as a simulation of what SLE4 looks like. So the first important step is to we look at the discrete harmonic measure as this claim. We fix some hexagon H, and we look at the discrete harmonic measure of the white hexagons from this hexagon H. Namely, this quantity is the probability that starting at H, a random walk will hit a white hexagon before hitting a black hexagon. Now, why is this time parameter here? Because as time goes on, time is discrete now, and as time goes on, the colors of the hexagons change. The hexagons near the interface, they become colored. They become white or black. Each time instant, a new hexagon is changed from gray to white or black. Now, the claim is that this HT is a martingale. Namely, the expectation of this quantity at time t plus 1, given what it is at time t, is exactly what it is at time t. Namely, if now my probability, now I know some information about the path, and now my probability is 75% to hit white, then at the next step, it's not going to be 75% anymore. It's going to change, but it's as likely to change upward as downward. That is the statement. It's as likely to change to 77% as it is to change to 73%, if these are the two possibilities, or it may be, you know, as likely to change to 80% as it is to change to 65%, if these are the two possibilities. And that implies that the expectation of HT is the same as H0. So that is the claim, and now the proof is rather short. Because if H prime is the hexagon that is decided between times T and T plus 1, then See, these two quantities refer to two different experiments. In one experiment, we start at H, we do a random walk, we stop when we see hexagons that are colored at time t. And in the other experiments, we stop either at, if we hit a hexagon colored at time t or if we hit H prime, because H prime is the hexagon that's colored between times t and t plus 1. These are two different experiments. Now, if the random walk, but we can fix the same random walk to do both experiments. If the random walk doesn't hit H prime, then the result in those two experiments is clearly the same. If it does visit H prime, well, we still don't know what color H prime was colored. But the probability that H prime is colored in a certain way is just the same as the probability that this random walk will now go and hit that particular color, because the continuation of the random walk after it hits H prime is the same as the random walk which starts at H prime. So this is a pretty simple coupling argument that says that the expectation of this quantity doesn't change in time. And a consequence is that HT is the probability that H is on the right-hand side of the path when everything is done, when all the hexagons are colored, because that is, well, at some T it's going to be on the right-hand side, and then the harmonic measure is going to be 1. And it's not too hard to see that you get the same property for SLE4. The probability to be on the right-hand side of the path is exactly the harmonic measure of the positive real ray. Okay. So now we consider, now we're going to use this fact to prove the convergence. And we isolated one quantity for which we know how its expectation evolves. Namely, the expectation doesn't change. Now we consider a very fine mesh, and we map our domain to the upper half plane, normalized in an appropriate way. And then our path gamma, when mapped over by this map, becomes a path in the upper half plane. And since it's a path in the upper half plane, we can apply Levenhoff's theorem. Levenhoff's theorem tells us about this W sub T and about these maps G sub T, and it tells us that G sub T, the maps G sub T, satisfy Levenhoff's equation. Now here's the next fact that we will use. We use the fact that discrete harmonic measure converges to the continuum harmonic measure, namely the probability that simple random walks hits a certain set approaches the probability that Brownian motion hits a close by set. So H tilde of T is the continuous harmonic measure we choose some point Z naught, and we let H tilde of T be the harmonic measure from GT of Z naught to the positive real ray. Well, I guess to the ray to the right of WT is more precise. So I have to say a few things here. One is that there's an explicit formula for the harmonic measure, which is the right-hand side here. See, well, harmonic measure is invariant under conformal mappings, and you can map the upper half plane by taking log. You can map it to the strip, and then the harmonic measure of the bottom of the strip is just the y-coordinate, And the log, the y-coordinate of the log function is the argument of your point, and that's why the argument here is the harmonic measure. And since the harmonic measure is approximately the discrete harmonic measure, and the discrete harmonic measure is a martingale, then the continuum harmonic measure is going to be approximately a martingale. So at this point, we don't know, we can't differentiate any of this because we don't know how bad W sub T is, but soon we will know. So what we will use is the fact that this thing, this quantity, is approximately a martingale, and from this we will deduce the behavior of W. So we should do it one step at a time, and I'll only do the first step. The next steps are essentially the same with only minor changes. We fix some positive delta, which you can think of just a very small constant. And we take the mesh much smaller than delta. And now we're going to have to make a cutoff, because you see, we want to do a Taylor expansion here. And once W gets to be too big, we're going to lose control over our Taylor coefficients. So we're going to have to stop at some time. And the first time that we stop is either when W deviates by at least delta from its initial position, or when time reached delta squared. And that's the appropriate stopping time to take. And that is tau. This will be the end of our first step. And we know by Levner's equation, now Z sub T is G sub T of, is just G sub T of Z zero. And we know how G sub T behaves because we know Levner's equation. Basically, Levner's equation says that G sub T is this thing plus that. That's the first approximation. That's when we ignore the fact that meanwhile this quantity is changing as well, right? Let me remind you that the differential equation is change of GT is 2 over GT minus WT. So in the interval between 0 and tau, we can first pretend that these don't change, that they stay G0 of Z0, which is just Z0, and W0. If we pretend that, then what we will get is just that term over there. We would get, well, we first have Z0 is what it used to be before, and then we have this term, and then we have to start thinking, well, as we were moving along here, these quantities changed as well. But how much do they change? Well, W changed by its most delta, and ZT also changed by its most delta, because, it changed by its most delta squared, in fact, because it's flowing according to some differential equation. So this thing changed its most by delta, and therefore, but here we have this tau, which is of order delta squared. It's at most delta squared, and therefore a mistake here of order delta will only change this term by order of delta cubed, and that's why the error is of order delta cubed. And if the mesh is small, the expectation of, well, I said this thing is approximately a martingale. Well, if it would be a martingale, the expectation of this thing is exactly the same as that thing. Well, but it's just approximately a martingale, and we can make the mesh sufficiently small so that the difference is as small as we like. In particular, we can make it bounded by delta cubed. And therefore, we have, well, this quantity is the same as this quantity, and this quantity is the same as that quantity, so this difference is at most delta cubed. And now again, we're going to Thank you. Now again, we're going to use Taylor expansion and use Lerner's equation again. And what you get is this, what you get is this second line here. This is what you get from the first line by applying Lerner's equation and Taylor expansion. So we get one equation. Well, what we really want to know here is what is delta W, which is W times tau minus W times zero. And we get here one equation involving the expectation of delta W, the expectation of delta W squared, and the expectation of tau. But the nice thing is that Z0 we chose arbitrarily, and we could choose another point. And by choosing another point, we can play around with what these coefficients here and here look like. And since these coefficients are linearly independent, we in fact get that both these equations hold. The expectation of delta W is bounded by delta cubed times the constant, and the same thing goes for the 4 tau minus delta W squared. The equations would be exactly zero if W over 2 was Brownian motion and tau is any stopping time. And then by repeating these steps again and again for the consecutive times, it's not too hard to show that W over 2 does converge to Brownian motion as delta goes to zero. Let me just say that why is the correct, why are the delta cubed terms not matter so much? Well, if you look at this equation, you see that the expectation of tau has to be of order delta squared, because tau is the first time in which either t is delta, is delta squared, in which case, you know, it is order delta squared, or it is the first time in which delta W is of order delta away from W naught, in which case this thing is of order delta squared, and therefore tau also has to be of order delta squared for the expectation to be small. So the expected time of each step is of order delta squared, and therefore we have to weight delta to the minus 2 steps to see a macroscopic effect in our equation, and therefore delta to the minus 2 steps, and in each one of these steps our errors here are only delta cubed. Delta to the minus 2 times delta cubed goes to zero, and therefore these delta cubed terms can be ignored. Well, are we done? Knowing that W over 2 converges to Brownian motion is good enough to show that the harmonic explorer path converges to SLE4 with respect to the Hausdorff metric. In fact, there is a stronger version of convergence which holds, but getting the stronger version requires other methods. I mean, you don't have to reprove convergence, you just need to say that if the convergence occurs here, then it will also occur in some stronger topology. Finally, this is the concluding slide. So we've seen a method by which you prove that some models converge to SLE. The first example where this actually worked was in a joint paper with Greg Lawler and Vendelin Werner, where we proved the convergence of the loop erased random walk. This followed essentially the same ideas, but was a little bit more complicated in the details, and this is why I preferred to discuss this model here. The upshot is to prove a convergence of one of these models, it's enough to be able to calculate one asymptotic formula for any particular observable. In this case, the observable was what is the probability to be on the right-hand side. In the case of the loop race random walk, an observable could be what is the probability that the what is the expected number of visits to a vertex by the random walk. For a self-avoiding walk, well, we don't have a proof yet, but maybe the observable would be what is the probability to be on the right-hand side. We don't know. The catch is that you need to be able to calculate this observable not in a very simple domain, but essentially in an arbitrary, simply connected domain. Not only in the domain you start with, but in all the possible domains you can get to as the path progresses. There's a similar proof that works for the discrete Gaussian free field. That is it. Thank you very much.